This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flint.
Well, Margaret, it's the season of giving, and I'm not talking about things you find in the shopping mall. In our line of work, we run across so many organizations that are truly doing meaningful work to ease the suffering of folks around the world.
Well, I've noticed a trend in recent years, Mark, and it's a really promising one. People giving to a charity in someone's name in lieu of a traditional holiday gift. And whether it's an organization that brings water wells to Africa, building schools and medical clinics in war-torn areas, a small or big donation can make a huge difference in the life of somebody who's suffering.
Some of the guests we've had on this past year would fit that bill. We had the CEO of Save the Children on our show, bringing health, shelter, substance, and schooling to children living in the front lines of war around the world. A small donation could provide a goat for a family or tuition for a schoolgirl for a year. There are so many ways to make a difference through their organization.
Another guest that's really stayed with me is Dr. Dean Marshbein, the director of the U.S. chapter of Doctors Without Borders, or Médecins Sans Frontières, who bring healthcare to some of the bleakest, most beleaguered places in the world. So we thought that we would revisit our conversations with Dr. Marshbein. She's overseeing some incredible delivery of care and compassion in places like Syria, Gaza, Afghanistan, and West Africa. And during this time of year, I can't think of a better person to highlight.
You're absolutely right. It was a terrific conversation. They're doing the really tough work out there across the globe.
And Laurie Robertson, the managing editor of FactCheck.org, will look at more false claims spoken about health policy in the public domain.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Dr. Dean Marshbein of Doctors Without Borders in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. After months of being held in limbo, Congress has finally approved President Obama's nomination for Surgeon General. Dr. Vivek Murthy, a physician at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston and professor at Harvard School of Medicine, won confirmation in a 51-43 vote. He is co-founder of Doctors for America, whose goal is to ensure affordable health care for all Americans. Murthy said his focus will be on reducing obesity, reducing tobacco use, and creating healthier communities. More states facing opposition by GOP opponents of health reform are forging ahead to expand Medicaid in spite of political pressure. Governors in Alaska and Tennessee among those moving strategically ahead with efforts to expand Medicaid to include more uninsured residents to gain coverage. And a survey of smaller U.S. businesses shows more are foregoing expensive insurance coverage, taking advantage instead of more comprehensive health plans being made available on the insurance exchanges. Companies with fewer than 50 employees represent about 20 million Americans in the workforce. These employers are not required under the health law to provide coverage, and many have found the deals on the exchanges, including tax subsidies for their employees who buy on the exchanges, are far better than both they and their employees could afford purchasing private insurance. E-cigarettes, the new gateway drug, the Center for Disease Control's most comprehensive survey on e-cigarette use among America's school children, shows there's been a dramatic rise in e-cigarette consumption. 70.1% of high school seniors reported smoking e-cigarettes in the past month, and almost 9% of eighth graders reported doing so, suggesting e-cigarettes are making smoking seem more normal. There was some good news in the survey, though. The abuse of prescription drugs among Americans' teens is down from a high in 2004, where roughly 9% had tried opioids like Vicodin or Oxycontin. Many of those kids went on to heroin abuse, a cheaper but more deadly route to the narcotic high. The numbers are now below 6%. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Dean Marshbein, president of the Board of Directors of Doctors Without Borders, winner of the 1999 Nobel Peace Prize, an international organization dedicated to offering health care and medical training in war-torn and impoverished countries around the world. Dr. Marshbein is an anesthesiologist practicing at Mass General Hospital in Boston. She earned her MD at the University of Pittsburgh and completed residency at Mass General and the Boston Children's Hospital. She also serves on the board of Vanconia Anemia Research Fund. Dr. Marshbein, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you very much.
You know, Doctors Without Borders was formed 40 years ago in 1971 in the context of the crisis in Biafra, and you joined the organization in 2006, taking over leadership of the U.S. chapter in 2012. And during that time, there's been no end to the world conflicts that Doctors Without Borders finds itself in. And I think people know about Doctors Without Borders in the abstract, but what's the core mission of Doctors Without Borders, and who are you serving around the world?
The premise was that we thought there needed to be an organization that could both deliver direct emergency medical care, but also speak out about the underlying causes and what we were seeing as we were working in those places. So the primary mission is, as I said, direct delivery of medical care and emergency aid to people affected by armed conflict, epidemics, malnutrition, natural disaster, and also situations where people are excluded from access to health care. And we're currently operating between 60 and 70 countries worldwide. So we have more than 30,000 people who are working for us, and about 10% of those are our international staff. And then we work very closely with locally acquired staff in the places where we work, and they really are the backbone of the work that we do. And those people, as the international staff, are doctors, they're nurses, they're logistics experts, administrators, epidemiologists, laboratory technicians, and even mental health workers. There's an important mental health component of most of the projects that we do.
Well, Dr. Marshbein, we are watching humanitarian and war zone crises just unfold before our eyes, it seems, almost every day. Your members are on the ground in West Africa, where the Ebola outbreak has led to hundreds of deaths and seems to be spreading, and I know has affected healthcare workers on the ground, the ongoing Syrian crisis. So maybe you could share with us a little bit about, in these hotspots, what are your healthcare workers experiencing there, and how do they grapple with delivering both the emergency medical care, but also you're delivering almost some primary care in an emergency environment?
All of these are really very diverse contexts, and one of the issues in Syria is that Syria had been a country where people had access to a very high level of health care, and obviously the needs and the expectations of the community are very different in a middle-income country than they are in sub-Saharan Africa. So, for instance, if you decide that you need to do a vaccination campaign, getting access to, say, the pneumococcal vaccine is $30 a dose versus the pennies to just a few dollars that we would have access to those supplies in the poor countries. So you're right, our resources are incredibly stretched at this point.
Back in 1971, you had 13 physicians, and as you just mentioned today, you employ some 30,000 health professionals and support staff all over the world. So tell us a little bit, first of all, about the types of people that are coming to you who are offering their services. Sort of, is there a screening mechanism that gets used? And then sort of down into the internal workings, the logistics of your field mission teams of doctors and nurses and support staff, how those are structured, and how do you get them ready for medical missions?
First of all, it's a global organization, so we are recruiting around the world. So, for instance, if we have a project in the Democratic Republic of Congo, we may identify people in that project who are really strong, capable people, and we may incorporate them into our international pool of volunteers. We require that people have professional experience in the area that they are purporting to go to. So a doctor would already have to be a doctor and have worked in their area of specialty. For things like logistics experts, they also have a test to analyze their ability to solve the kinds of problems that they're going to encounter in the field. But more importantly, how they think about things, their flexibility of mind, their ability to take experiences that they've had in one setting and apply them to another. And then there is training that happens before they go to the field. But honestly, the best training that people get is the handover, the one-on-one training in the field. And one of the things about MSF is there's a lot of really grassroots experimentation and working out different problems in the field that then gets reported and incorporated into a broader space and exported to different projects.
You know, our organization started in 1972 with a great idea and a mission, and certainly we are well familiar with all organizations that seek to do good in the world. Start with a great idea, and the challenges of infrastructure catch up with you as you're growing and expanding. So we'd be really curious to hear from your perspective, what have been the major changes within Doctors Without Borders or Médecins Sans Frontières, MSF? What has really carried through from the beginning?
When they first started, and I look at what the first volunteers did, they literally came with the medical bags that they could carry. And when I think about the sophisticated kind of medical care that I have personally delivered in some of the places, very remote places that we've delivered it, I think about how amazing it is that we've been able to do that. And first and foremost, I think it's our logistics. So I got a phone call a few hours after the earthquake in Haiti. And at the same time that I was dispatched from Boston to Port-au-Prince, a plane left our logistics center in Bordeaux. And it had an inflatable hospital with everything that you could possibly imagine that would be needed for a hospital. So there's this great thought process that went into, if I have a cholera epidemic, what do I need to treat cholera for 10,000? If I have a surgical emergency, what kind of hospital do I need? And so all of that has been carefully thought out. And when I go to the field, all I take is myself. And know that there is systemization of the material that I will find there, of the pharmaceuticals, and that allows me to really hit the ground running. It's delivering medical care to the people most in need, and that is core to our DNA.
We're speaking today with Dr. Dean Marchbein, President of the Board of Directors of Doctors Without Borders USA, an international organization dedicated to offering healthcare and medical training in war-torn and impoverished countries around the world. You talked about hitting the ground, and we hit the ground most often. You're running into women and children who've suffered the most, and so you're dealing with a lot of maternal and child health issues. You've got the logistics and the technology there, but I'm certainly interested in the cultural competency that comes in. How well equipped are you in that sort of cultural context to deliver care?
Actually, I think the cultural component and competency is super important. There's always a cultural briefing. The perfect example of how important that cultural sensitivity is was Afghanistan. Afghanistan, basically in a state of war and conflict for the last 25 or 30 years, with some of the world's highest maternal mortality figures. And so MSF decided that we really needed to be working in Afghanistan, and one of the places that we opted to work is a town called Khost, which is on the border with Pakistan. And so the team that was investigating what kind of mission we should do sat down with the community, sat down with men, sat down with women in the community to let them decide and inform us about what their most pressing health needs were. And it was the community that said we really need help with maternal health because the levels of maternal mortality are just unacceptable. And so we opted to open a maternal hospital. And more than that, we decided to make ourselves really valuable to the community. We would staff it entirely with female staff. So every single job in the hospital. So there were international staff that came, and each of the international staff's job was to train local people to do their jobs. Midwives needed to be trained, obstetricians needed to be trained, the interpreters needed to be hired, the guards who would check every person entering the hospital for weapons needed to be women, and they needed to be trained. And during the time that we have been there, which I think is almost 2 years now, there has not been a single death of a mother who arrived at our hospital not already practically dead. And in a community where women have children on average one every 15 to 24 months. When you're doing 12,000 to 15,000 deliveries a year, it doesn't take very long before you've had a major impact on the community.
Well, that's a profound example and kind of directly segues into what I wanted to ask you about, which is really population health, which we certainly are talking a lot about in the United States under health reform. But certainly population health takes on a whole new meaning in the areas where you are working. And I know that you've had some, such as your campaign for essential medicines and your nutrition programs in sub-Saharan Africa and elsewhere. Maybe tell us what you've learned about successful population health management in some of these targeted zones. You know, maybe you could share some success stories about both what your organization and the other NGOs and entities that are working to achieve the goals of the UN Millennium Project are learning from this experience.
So the Access Campaign is a campaign that we developed using the proceeds from the 1999 Nobel Peace Prize. And the reason that we decided that we needed a campaign to assure access to essential medications was because we found that in the field we did not have access to the kinds of medicines that we needed were either too expensive or they were simply not geared toward the needs of the populations that we were addressing. So, and that's pretty typical of medical research, which is geared toward the drugs and the diagnostic tests are being developed on the basis of their future market potential rather than the needs of particularly people who live in poor countries. And so that was really the basis for the Access campaign. Our goals are a little bit different from the Millennium goals. The Millennium goals are basically to increase human well-being over a period of time through economic and social development. And MSF is an emergency organization, so it's not really the same platform, but some of our work can and does contribute to global strategies. So one of the global goals is reducing childhood mortality. And one of the projects that we have implemented is seasonal malarial chemoprophylaxis. And so you go to a place that has seasonal malaria where there is a very high mortality deaths, in, especially in children under 5 years old. And these are children often with comorbidity that includes malnutrition and anemia. And in addition to taking the usual preventive measures to prevent mosquito bites, and you treat them with medicines during that period of time. And while seasonal malaria chemoprophylaxis is not a cure, in conjunction with other methods to prevent malaria, it's been a huge success. So we started it first in Niger, and it's now being trialed in a number of other places. And the results have been so exciting that recently UNITAID announced a $67.4 million grant to the Malaria Consortium to implement seasonal malaria prophylaxis in places like Burkina Faso and Chad and Guinea, Mali, Niger, Nigeria, and Gambia. And according to UNITAID, so this is UNITAID's information, not ours, they're expecting that this will provide 30 million treatments every year, and this will protect 7.5 million children. And it's estimated that this will prevent 50,000 deaths. Wow. So this is an area where essentially the Access campaign, the Millennium Project, and the goals found an area of corresponding interest and work.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Dean Marchbein, President of the Board of Directors of Doctors Without Borders USA, known internationally as Médecins Sans Frontières, an international organization dedicated to offering health care and medical training in war-torn and impoverished countries around the world. You can learn more about their work by going to doctorswithoutborders.org. Dr. Marchbein, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you very much.
Hey,
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Well, the Urban Institute is out with a new report that looks at how the Affordable Care Act has affected the number of uninsured. Its survey data showed that the number of uninsured adults dropped by 8 million between September and June. The percentage of uninsured in the United States was an estimated 13.9% in June, compared with 17.9% in September. The drop in the percentage of uninsured was more pronounced in states that expanded Medicaid under the ACA. In those states, the rate of uninsured was 10.1% in June, a 6 percentage point drop from September. Meanwhile, the states that haven't expanded Medicaid, there are currently 24 of them, have an uninsured rate of 18.3%, down slightly from a 20% rate in September. These are, of course, only estimates from a survey taken a few months after the first open enrollment period under the healthcare law. The data don't include a breakdown of the sources of insurance for the previously uninsured. They do, however, show that the insurance gains overwhelmingly occurred in families whose incomes were below 400% of the federal poverty level. That's $95,400 for a family of four this year, making those families eligible for subsidies on the insurance marketplaces or Medicaid coverage. The survey, which has been taken quarterly since 2013, is funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Urban Institute. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have factcheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. As the saying goes, music soothes the savage beast. And according to a recent study conducted by Queen's University in Belfast, Ireland, there's some empirical data to back that up. In a first-of-a-kind longitudinal study, children suffering from a variety of behavioral and emotional conditions who were exposed to music therapy in addition to traditional therapies had far better outcomes than those children in a control group that offered traditional therapy without music therapy.
Basically, it's about treating children with emotional and behavioral problems with music therapy in addition to normal psychiatric care. It's not a matter of them being given music or choosing music. They actually make music along with the music therapist assisting them. So the idea is for them to express themselves through music.
Lead researcher Dr. Sam Porter said there's been anecdotal evidence that music improves mood in children and adolescents as well as adults, but his study revealed just how effective the music therapy was.
Our primary outcome was an improvement in communication. Now, there were two very interesting secondary outcomes, levels of depression and levels of self-esteem. And in the secondary outcomes, we found a statistically significant difference between the control group and the intervention group.
Dr. Porter says in the group given musical therapy, it showed over time more interaction with their surroundings and a better response to the traditional therapies as well. And he says the effects were sustained over time.
I mean, that's one of the marvelous things about music therapy, is the things that it's not. There are no side effects. It is not a dangerous therapy to get kids involved, and it is a productive way of getting kids to improve their health. So it is just such a good way and a harmless way of doing things. So it's really satisfying to know that it's also an effective way of doing it.
The study was conducted in conjunction with the Northern Ireland Music Therapy Trust, which sees the promising findings as an incentive to incorporate this relatively low-cost, non-invasive therapy into standard protocols as an additional tool to enhance outcomes for the youth population, which often suffers negative side effects from powerful medications. A simple, targeted music therapy approach, age-appropriate and showing great efficacy in improving outcomes for young patients with minimal side effects and lasting benefits, now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.